Over 20 years ago, Mike Biddle, a trailblazing plastics engineer, launched MBA Polymers in his garage. He was determined to prove that complex polymers from consumer plastics could be recycled into useful raw materials. Mike developed a patented series of techniques for separating and refining plastic waste to produce quality materials for reuse in industry. His innovative recycling process diverts plastic waste from landfills and the ocean while negating the need for new oil-based plastics. But of course, he didn't stop there. Mike shifted his focus from solving one big world problem to another even bigger world problem, how to recycle carbon. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. I'm sure that our listeners are excited by that intro, knowing that we are about to spend the next hour talking with and learning from our guest, Mike Biddle. He's going to share with us the story of his journey from garbage man to carbon wrangler and investor. He is currently the managing director of Evoke. Is that right, Mike? Is it Evoke?
It is. Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
Evoke without the E, which is why I'm asking.
Innovations. That's correct.
A fund that offers a unique approach to innovation, combining the pace and creativity of Silicon Valley startup with the experience and insight of industry leaders. And his story is powerful and impactful. Trust me on this one. Mike, you can tell I'm really excited to have you here, and I'm ready.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
It's a great story. And we should announce that your YouTube video just went over 1 million views. And that is
correct.
A big deal. I mean, YouTube is a very crowded space. I don't remember how many are put up a day. And to pass the $1 million mark, it's so on my bucket list. And I'm going to do it even if it takes me until I'm 80 years old, I swear.
Well, it's interesting. It passed 1 million on the TED platform. It was a main TED platform. There is a YouTube version of it that is less than 1 million, but the main version is on the TED platform is over 1 million.
And TED is the place. I mean, TED is the place. That's where I want to be. And I said YouTube because I usually click on that to view it. But a TED talk that gets over 1 million views, as I would say in close circles, it's really a thing. It's a really big thing. So articulate. Okay. Let's start with, there really are such things as aha moments. I had one, which is why I started Mrs. Green's World and went off on this crazy journey. But there are moments when you actually see the light bulb. You might not really know it's the light bulb right then, but you can't ignore it. What was your light bulb or aha moment around polymers and recycling into raw materials? How did you see that that was even possible or think that it was?
Right. No, it's a great question. I think there were probably many things that led up to the aha moment, but I think it would probably, I could probably best describe it as a combination of two things. First, many decades ago, I decided to become an engineer and a chemical engineer and eventually found my way into becoming a plastics engineer. And this was, nearly 40 years ago. And at the time, plastics was a space age awesome, cool material.
Right.
And while I was a plastics engineer, I was finding it was starting to change from the coolest material on the planet to one that people were starting to become concerned about, rightly. And that's we're going to get into that, I'm sure, and have 30, 40 years later, have become very concerned about it for very good reasons. And I felt that. I felt, well, here's my passion. I know this material has some great attributes, but I can see some problems with it, and particularly on what we problems that are manifested because of how we deal with plastics at end of life. And so I think that was the first touch point. And then the second one, probably the point where the coin really dropped. I don't know how many of your viewers will remember this, but there was a garbage barge from,
yes.
I think it was from Philadelphia.
My God.
And that was on the news.
Nobody would let it land.
Exactly.
Oh my God, so, I still remember that.
Yeah, it was a combination of we're running out of places to put all our garbage, nobody wants it, plus the material that I had decided to focus my professional career on that I thought was this awesome material was becoming maybe less awesome in my mind and other people's minds. And I wanted to do something about that. And it really bothered me. And I thought there was a better way to deal with the way our plastic waste, but also a better way to make plastics instead of from petrochemicals, which was also becoming, you may remember the fuel crisis and the long lines filling up your gas tanks. So there was this sense that we were going to run out of oil, which of course hasn't really manifested itself yet, or it hasn't really been realized yet. I think it was a combination of all those things around the same time period that made me realize there's got to be a better way.
And Mike, can you imagine our kids, or in my case, grandkids, thinking about lines? I mean, I remember before I was married to my husband and he came to see me, he would go to the gas station like at 5 a.m. so that I could get gas to drive to the train station. I mean, nobody thinks about that anymore. It's just not a thing. And you're right, it didn't realize, but you know, it should have been a wake-up call that we should start finding alternatives so we're not hostage to those situations. So you were at Dow Chemical at the time, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
How were they doing when you talked to them about your How'd that go?
Yeah, I went to my R&D director at the time and I said, hey, you know, I think we ought to be recycling these plastics. And the first reaction was, well, we didn't hire a PhD in material science and polymer science to work on garbage. He literally said that. Those are his real words. And I get it. You know,
I get it. It looked like, you know, they had a different mission.
Sure. You know, garbage in equals garbage out in his mind. And it took me 6 to 9 months, but I convinced him otherwise. And he let me start a research project inside the company to see if it was even possible to recycle plastic. And once I proved it was, I guess I did a good enough job, they actually sent me to Stanford Business School. So
I didn't for my research. That's a great reveal in this. That's great.
Yeah. I have a lot of respect for Dow from that standpoint.
And I read some things about Dow that I think are positive. I mean, I'm not going to put them up as the green champion for 2019, but they are doing things in the sustainability space, I believe, that are really going to help move the planet forward. Some of those big bad wolves that we talk about, their R&D will end up helping us a lot. At least that's what I believe.
It's taken them a few decades to get their head around it. I had to leave. When I came back from Stanford, I came back with a business plan in my hand about how to turn this research into a business. And since they wouldn't let me turn it into a business and wanted me to keep researching it, that's when I went off on my own.
Thank you for that wonderful education. And I hope we have a good farewell party for Mike. So that's like, we can't gloss over this. You had to face, this was not a straight line, your journey from we're going to go here and then here's the solutions. How long did it take and what were some of the challenges to bring your ideas to market? Because you need to tell us what you ultimately did discover and what happened. I mean, that's all part of these many questions I have, but what were some of the biggest challenges to get from point A to point B when you had to go to point Z?
Right, exactly. And all the letters in between.
Yes, that's so right. You didn't miss one, I'm sure. Maybe the R was for rest. Take a breath.
Right. Yeah. A lot of detours along the way. Yes. It's like any other in the space I work in now, the investing in this space, we call it the clean tech and hard tech space. hard meaning, literally meaning that this is difficult, but also meaning that you probably have to build big facilities and big infrastructure to pull this some of these clean tech things off. And indeed, my adventure included building very large factories. So I think there were many difficulties along the way. The first, it's always harder than you think it's going to be, even though I showed it was possible, but you know, turning an idea that
I agree with you so much. It's like, yeah, start Mrs. Green's world. How's that working for you?
All right. Yeah, and that's the story with every startup I've ever met. It's going to be harder than you think, but you know, we're going to be here with you. And thankfully, I had investors that were there with me and weren't happy about how long it was taking, but stuck there with me, and a team. I built a team that was just as passionate about solving the problem as I was. And I think those got us through those hard times of first figuring out how to make the technology really work, then how to scale it to a pilot, then how to scale it to a small manufacturing plant, and then how to design and build and operate our first world scale plant. And I can tell you all of those were much longer journeys than we expected. But then, you know, finally after the second plant, I would say we finally got it right and started making money.
And
it was almost a 20-year journey from idea to making money at a large scale. More like 15 years.
That is a long pregnancy.
It is.
I mean, that is really a long journey. And I don't know where this fits in, but you and I spoke a little bit off air about taking the show in a direction. And I have to tell you, last night, my daughter and I watched that special about the Theranos founder, Elizabeth Holmes.
Oh, right.
And
yeah,
I'm like,
right.
How could she do that? Which we're not going to go off on that target, but here is a real idea that can have real impact on humans. Your idea. Help the health of the planet, the help our health, the help of the oceans, wildlife, the health, all that. And these are some of the biggest challenges. And then you do a podcast interview and it's reduced to a couple of sentences when it was years of work and saying, I'm going to bet the farm,
right.
I'm going to risk everything I have, I'm going to put my own money into it, and I might end up bankrupt and, you know, homeless. I mean, that can happen. But you stuck with it. So what happened? You talked about a number of factories. What did you find and how were you successful at impacting the way products are produced?
Well, just before I answer that specific question, I love that you scratched that surface a bit, because a lot of entrepreneurs start something, and one of the things I look for, and I look them in the eye and I say, do you really know what you're getting into, particularly
no
if it's going to be, a hard tech venture where I know they're going to have to raise huge amounts of money and build big factories to bring their big idea to market.
And what do they say? They don't know unless you do it.
They don't know, but you can kind of, you say, you know, do you have a family? Have you talked to your family about what this might mean? And, you know, how many hours you're going to be spending? I can't tell you how many nights I slept on the floor. I eventually bought a futon and moved it into my office.
I can, in
the factory, just because I didn't want to waste the time to drive home and come back, you know?
How
many times I had to write a check to make payroll, or, you know, make a loan or go without pay, not just me, some of my other team members. So it's a difficult journey, and it's not for the faint of heart. And I think there maybe are some hard tech entrepreneurs out there that haven't had to go through some of those pains, but I don't know many, frankly.
There are few one-hit wonders, as I call them, very few. And I remember when I started a company, had no intention whatsoever to be an entrepreneur. I loved working for people. I loved being in charge of the company that I worked for, but I loved working for people. And a friend of mine, and I remember him to this day, and it was over 30 years ago, Charlie Meeker, he kept saying to me, well, Gina, are you willing to bet the farm? Because you might lose the farm. I said, what do you mean, Charlie? Are you willing to bet the farm? And I'll never forget a time when our biggest payer, this was in large volume mental health contracts, stopped paying because their system was so screwed up, and they said they were going to not pay us for 3 months. And it was a third of my revenue. And I went to the bank, had a great relationship, thank God, it was a regional bank. And I said to my friend Dave, I said, Dave, if you don't lend me more money, we're shutting the door and I already owe you some money. And he said, I'll never forget it. He said, what else have you got? And literally, thank God, I had two sets of silver. I had some jewelry. And then we put the house as collateral. And I came home and I had to look at my husband and say, we're betting the farm here. We don't have a farm, but we're betting it. So that's part of what I love about your story. Yeah, it's a lot of risk and a lot of work, and it doesn't happen overnight unless you're Mark Zuckerberg.
And I had to sign personal loan guarantees two different times for more than I was worth at the time.
Yes.
So, it would have wiped me out.
I know. So. I remember this guy, Dave, saying to me, he said, Gina, you better make this work because we don't want your silver. I never forget.
Those
things that you have along the way. So back to the topic at hand, and this is really all part of it. For the budding entrepreneurs out there, if you have the idea, my thing would be stay with it. And if it's in your gut, you go for it against all odds and you just keep showing up. So I'm sure that's what you'd say. Stay on it. So how did you do in impacting the ways products are produced and creating a more sustainable way to make plastics? What happened?
Well, I'm happy to say now MBA has three world scale plants. So we sold the company a couple of years ago now.
Which is everybody's dream too. You did the good and you can really get the rewards for it. That's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't as big of an exit as I or our investors were hoping for, but it was time. It was time to put it in people's hands that had the financial wherewithal to grow the company, to take it to the next stages. So I think that's happening. I've heard that another plant is underway, but to be honest, I haven't followed it closely. Because as you've mentioned,
you're changing,
I don't know if we'll have time
world.
To get to it. I've got another. I'm recycling something much more difficult to recycle these days, or trying to help companies do that.
Right.
But the plastics, yeah. And I still, it's still in my blood. It will never leave because I spent so many years at it. Plus, I feel like I know a thing or two about it. So I still field calls from all over the world, literally on how might someone get into this. I clearly refer them to my former company, but I also give them advice and tell them some of the shortcuts from a business standpoint and some of the obstacles they're going to have to overcome to make it happen, like securing enough supply. That was, to be honest, one of our biggest, after getting the technology to work and work at scale and getting the plants to work like well-oiled machines, one of our biggest challenges, counterintuitively, was how to get enough material into the plants and feed them. Because to make this work economically,
yes,
like you have to be at scale. You have to be at large scale, not for the what are called economies of scale. And that's a lot of what has to do with hard tech. You tend to have to build things at a reasonably large scale to compete with existing the incumbents in many industries, energy industry, you know, commodity industry. To be able to compete, you have to do things at scale. Plus, if you're going to sell to customers like we were, the automotive industry, the computer industry, they need large amounts of material on a reliable basis and consistent basis, and that means scale. So to do this at scale, it means you have to feed it at scale, and you think there's so much plastic waste in the world. Well, getting your hands on it and getting it delivered to your plant can sometimes be a challenge when you're
people
talking
throw
about
it in the,
you know,
garbage.
Large amounts.
They throw things in the garbage. The landfills are full of it. And one, which is a perfect segue, one of the things you and I talked about a week ago, you also see mountains of trash as above ground mines. Why are they mines waiting to be explored? And my friend Jason, he sees landfills as underground places to be explored and all of the things extracted from them. So why do you see that mountain of trash as something exciting and wish you could get your hands on it in a large scale?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It was resources when it was first mined from the earth or from oil and turned into plastic molecules, in the case of polymers. So they started its life as resources in the ground, typically under the ground, and then made into products. And then when those products die, it's a bundle of different resources all bundled together and mixed with other products that are made of different resources.
Right.
And they're just all mixed together, much like when you find the resources underground, they're typically mixed with other elements. So that's how I viewed it. We mine. We figured out how to mine. We figured out how to refine petroleum products into other products like plastics. We ought to be able to unmine, if you will, unmine those products and reconstitute them. And basically, that's what we did. It's much harder than it sounds because they tend to, you know, when you make a product, you want the different materials that make up that product. You want them to stay together pretty well, and we have to kind of unstick them, if you will.
I know. It is so complicated, but I don't think we ever said exactly what you do, and I'm scared that I understand it, but you took hard plastic and you figured out a way to break it down to the microbeads and then put it back together again. Is that the layman's version, or is it a little more complicated than that? Like you broke Humpty Dumpty down, but you figured out how to put it back together again.
Well, and at the time that was also thought to be heresy because at the time, and still, to be honest, pretty much today, most of the plastic that still gets recycled on the planet are your water bottle, your PET water bottle, maybe your milk jug, which is polyethylene. So those are the two most recycled materials today, largely because there's a lot of bottles and milk jugs and containers like shampoo containers and so forth made out of those two plastics. And machines and fairly simple sorting technology and humans are all used in today's existing recycling lines to sort those products at the object level.
Right.
So at a bottle level.
Right.
So you use something called infrared spectroscopy. You also can use sink float gravity density differences of the plastics, but typically at a MRF where your garbage can is first dumped at what's called a MRF, a material recycling facility, where the mixed recyclables are sorted by glass and
hey,
and
Mrs. Green has been
paper.
To the MRF here numerous
okay.
times. I'm a freak. My friends say, why are you so excited about going to the recycling plant? Because if you see it, you don't ever forget it. I take tours out there.
It's a great thing to do.
It is.
I'm glad you do that.
Do.
It's an eye-opening experience for people that haven't seen it, exactly.
And in Tucson, you don't want to go in the summer, trust me.
You the just smells can be pretty.
As soon as the temperature gets below 80, you're safer.
Right,
so go ahead.
I can imagine.
It's a big deal what you're talking about, a complex carbohydrate.
Yeah, and so if we just take the plastic stream that's kind of sorted from the rest, it's never perfectly sorted, of course, but it's predominantly plastic. And most of these MRFs will sort it into two types of plastics, the PET bottle. So again, like your water bottle, your soda bottle and so
right,
forth, the
right.
clear plastic, and polyethylene, which is milk jugs and maybe shampoo containers, things like that. Those are the two predominant materials that get recycled today because so many containers are made out of those materials, and it's easy for the combination of something called infrared spectroscopy, which is just it's a certain wavelength of light that shines on the plastic, can say whether it's one type of plastic or another. That's imperfect. So humans then are usually positioned after those machines to fix the misses or mistakes that the
right.
machine made. And humans also make mistakes. Things get through. So by the time you end up, maybe your stream is 80 to 90% predominantly that one material that gets put into a bale, squished into a bale, and sent then to a plastics recycling facility, which then has a fairly simple job of shredding that material to small bits, cleaning it up, washing it, trying to get the labels off. The caps are often made from a different material, so separating that material from the bottle and cleaning the residue of the Coke or the milk
right,
or whatever
right.
was in there from that material, and then creating a fairly pure stream that goes into making new bottles, your Patagonia clothes, et cetera.
Yeah, there's more uses for it.
Yep.
And I really don't want to go into the whole China taking, stopping to take 90% of the plastics, because I want to get on to what you're
yeah.
doing now. But it is a big deal because there used to
yeah.
be markets for it. And it was the shock heard around the United States when that mandate came out from our friends in China.
Right. And well, those two plastics I talked about they're also labeled ones and twos if you look on the bottom
right.
of your bottle.
Right.
And again, those are the predominant ones. But there's a lot of residual plastic that doesn't get recycled. That was what was some of the ones and twos got shipped to China, but predominantly that mixed plastic got shipped to China. And that's what they said, stop sending us this garbage. We can't sort
yeah.
it either. You guys couldn't sort it. We can't sort it.
Oh, my God.
So
and
that's
they have
the problem.
They have mountains of garbage.
They do. Well, and I'm finally glad they said, stop sending it to
yeah.
us. I'd been telling them to say that for 20 years, even though I had a plant in China. I said, you're being dumped on. And so what they do is to kind of finish the story on how does it end up in the oceans. So that those mixed plastics, the threes through sevens, they're often
right.
called, or the byproduct plastics from these MRFs is what was predominantly sent to China. They would pull out what was missed. They would get out the ones and twos, anything a human could recover. And they would also do some very crude sink float technologies, density separations, but very crude. And they would be left with a huge amount of plastic they couldn't figure out how to sort. That would often get dumped down a hillside or down a ravine. And guess what's at the bottom of ravines and hillsides?
No
streams.
Kidding.
And those streams eventually end up into the oceans. And the beauty of them dumping it down the streams, from their perspective, into the streams is they're self-cleaning, right? They can dump again tomorrow because the stream carried it away, and away was to the oceans. And these people, I've been to many of these facilities. They're not bad people. They're just trying to earn a living, and they don't know what to do with the stuff that they can't recycle. They can't figure out what type of plastic it is. So.
And they're not the villains. It's like we're going to talk about that, because one of the things that I know you believe in is a circular economy, which basically is an economic system where you minimize waste and make the most of the resources. But
yep.
it's not not looking for shame, blame, or guilt with the bad guy, but I always say to people that I get to have relationships with when they're so proud of their recycling efforts, I say, yeah, that's wonderful, and I'm so proud of you. And if I have the relationship or I feel safe when I'm doing public speaking, I say, but just remember the first R is reduce. That's what we yep. all have to be focusing on. We should take those other two away and say reduce, because that's where we're going to, you know, get to some type of end game. But yep. how important...
Well, I think the other R is responsibility. So be responsible for your waste.
I love that. And you're a hashtag waiting to happen. You are a tweet. Hashtag the next R is responsibility. And you're so right, because that's what I think the biggest challenge is when we all have our mindset that we're not even aware pretty much of how those mindsets came to be. But from your perspective and what you've done globally and the impact you've had, how important is it that we shift our mindsets? Would you say it's at the critical stage? I mean, I know what I'd say. But.
Yeah, and it is for so many reasons. There is a finite amount of resources on the planet, and we need to conserve those. We need to and use them responsibly and sensibly. We've still got more humans coming to the planet, and more importantly, we've got more humans that aspire, rightly so, to lifestyles that approach our lifestyles. You know, they expect, McKinsey did a study a few years ago, they expect 2 billion more middle-class consumers to come to the planet. And if they consume anything like Americans, you know, there's going to be a lot more material consumed and energy and so forth. So that material has to be, that material has to enter a circular loop. It cannot be these linear pathways that we've come to enjoy. And so that gets to your circular comment. We have to figure out how to get these resources back and use them again sensibly. And it saves energy, it saves pollution, it saves our resources, and it saves money. We eventually got to the point where our plastics were cheaper to make than making them in these huge petrochemical plants that had all the advantages, economies of scale, optimized supply chains, et cetera. We were able to outcompete them because it does make more sense to reuse resources than to make them anew.
And what I would add to that is that it saves lives. And that's what we have to start thinking about. One of our partners
Absolutely.
Here is a big, it's 1,200 employees in a wonderful El Rio Community Health Center. And one of their grant writers sent me some recent research on the impact of plastics and air quality on health, because now they're measuring it. So yes, we'll save oceans and we'll save this and we'll save energy. It's going to save our lives. And that's what I'm trying to get across, and not in a scary way, but the life you save may be your own. And when I do shows on fish and the plastics found in fish, trust me, people should not be eating fish. They should not be eating fish, because there's very few plastic-free fish from what I can, talking to the experts. So let's go to, I know that you're not worried about running out of energy in the sense that the sun will come out tomorrow, but you do care deeply about clean energy and carbon. What should we as a global community be focusing on in terms of solution? What is your work looking at now?
Right. Thank you for asking. I shifted my focus, as you alluded to earlier, from plastics waste to CO2 waste, and for a lot of reasons. One, I and many other folks, researchers on the planet, believe that climate change is probably one of the big existential threats to humanity. Probably one of the just a couple that I tend to worry about, nuclear threat being another one.
I know. Agreed.
But climate change, I think, is coming for sure. There is no one that I respect and know that doubts that. The question is how quickly and how big is it going to be? I think regardless of what that answer is, it's coming. It's going to impact the way we live today, and it's going to impact future generations, my kids and their kids. So that's the one I'm focused on. We know CO2 and other greenhouse gases like methane, which leaks from various sources, are big contributors to the climate change phenomena. CO2 being the one that gets talked about the most and the one that that we tend to focus on, methane being probably the second one that we tend to focus on as a group. And what we're doing is not all that different than what I tried to do with plastics, is try to get it get it away from where it's doing harm, i.e. the atmosphere, and put it back into a place where we can make use of it. So we're doing carbon recycling, or we're investing in companies and technologies that are trying to do carbon recycling. And plastics was difficult. It turns out carbon is more difficult.
Oh my God, first, that's hysterical. You didn't want to go with the easy route. Let's take on something way bigger, a climb that will really keep you interested for the rest of your life.
I guess I didn't learn my lesson from my first hard adventure.
Thank goodness.
But that's why I'm investing in other companies to do it. Yeah. So I'm letting these younger, smarter entrepreneurs do it. I just invest in them and coach them and help them build their teams and get to their solutions faster.
Thank goodness. So I want to know what excites you. And I have to talk about it for a minute, but I get hope from things like Paul Hawken. I've met him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I've had him on the show. Catherine Wilkinson. So they're basically on the same mission to sequester carbon, literally draw it down from the atmosphere. So you have to tell us, you don't ever have to, but I want to hear about what are you doing? We need people to make, create, and innovate. I would think you live in an exciting space. So what are some of the things that excite you? What kind of things can you explain to all of us in terms of recycling carbon? What does that even mean? What does it look like?
Sure. Again, thank you for asking. Let me just first, I'm going to draw an analogy since we started off with my plastics adventure, if you will. Yeah, there's a lot of analogies, frankly, besides being difficult to recycling, put back in the bag, if you will, or put back in the box.
Right.
One analogy, and particularly around ocean plastic waste, is we have to do two things simultaneously. We have to stop dumping it into the ocean in the first place. So we have to reduce the amount of plastic that's entering the oceans, because it's just an enormous amount that goes in every single day. And then we have to figure out ways of getting it out of the ocean. And both of those are ongoing. And getting it out of the ocean is actually more difficult, but we still need to work on it. With CO2, it's the same thing. Getting the CO2 out of the air is very difficult because it's so dilute. I mean, 400 parts per million is wreaking havoc with climate, or more like 410 now, I think we're at. But 410 parts per million is very difficult to, you know, grab those molecules cheaply and concentrate them to a point where the CO2 can actually be then used as building blocks for new materials. So I'll come back to that. But that is, we are working on that, and we have investments in companies that are trying to solve that problem.
Mind-boggling. And just let me press pause here. When you think about the analogy, you can see plastic bottles, plastic lids, plastic caps. You can't even see carbon.
Right.
So there go, and you're trying to capture it. Yeah.
Exactly. And just one more thing on that plastic in the oceans, because it's something that's more tangible to many people.
Yes,
because
understandable.
You can sort of see it. But to be honest, when you're out there, and I went on a expedition with my daughter about 2 years ago on a sailing expedition with Five Gyres, which is one of the many great organizations trying to solve plastic in the ocean problem. And we spent 2 weeks studying from the Bahamas to New York, and we sailed through the North Atlantic Gyre, dragging a screen, a trawl, and sampling the oceans. We wouldn't see ships for days, but we would find plastic in every single trawl sample we took, and we'd find it in small fish, et cetera, as you pointed out earlier. And it was, you couldn't see it. You couldn't see, most of it you couldn't see with your eyes, but because it had broken up into small particles, but we were finding it in our screening system. Yeah, CO2 is even harder to see and find. It's even more dilute. It is daunting, and it's energetically, it's not easy to put it back in the bottle, if you will, and suck it out of the air. There has to be a huge effort, and I think many efforts around the globe are more focused on trying to reduce emissions. And that gets to, I think, a comment you made earlier about using cleaner fuels. I have solar on my house. I ride my bicycle everywhere, so I try not to start my car very often.
Right.
I take public transport, which uses energy, and depending on where the energy came from, it may be generating CO2 or may not. So doing those things are extremely important. We air dry our clothes, we've gone mostly vegan. I'm not saying these are things that every human on the planet needs to do, but these things have made a big difference. And I've even calculated the difference that our family has made just by those three or four small changes we've made in our lifestyle. And so we have to work on how we each behave individually and what we each do individually, how we consume energy, how we consume products, but also companies and governments and industries have to adopt policies and behaviors that also lower their carbon footprint. I would, so both have to happen simultaneously. And as an investor and company builder, we're investing in both sides of that equation. Companies that are trying to pull it out of the air and pull it out of flue gases, you know, from power plants.
Right, right.
Which is more concentrated, so a bit easier, but it's also more contaminated, so that makes it more difficult. And then also trying to create energy sources that won't generate any or as much CO2. For example, clean hydrogen. Made two investments in that space.
My husband brings that up a lot. I mean, he just says hydrogen. And it's not, it's that same thing where there's not, you can't go from A to Z. It's such a, there's so many issues around all of it in terms of infrastructure and things like that.
Yep.
You know, it's funny the way that our first conversation went and how wonderful I feel about this conversation. And it's, you bring up another point that's so relevant to my journey. I read a book, people send me books now because we're on the screen of environmental and sustainable platforms. And this guy sent me a book called The Yin and the Yang of Climate Change. And I'm kind of spiritually woo-woo. You know, my journey started deep in the rainforest when I realized my aha moment was like, if we tear these down, we are screwed. And I don't want to be crass, but like we are in deep and serious trouble, and talking to shamans about the North and meeting Lynn and Bill Twist and all of those things. I'm like, people living in Tucson are not thinking about how much the rainforest lives in their oxygen supply. You know what I mean?
Right.
But this book, it's absolutely to your point, and I don't want to gloss over it. The book impacted me so much. I'm not kidding. I went and had a necklace made by my friend who is a sustainable, no dirty gold jeweler. That is a yin and the yang symbol. And what he said is just what you talked about, the personal changes that you made. The solutions to climate change start with an inside job. And that's what, on this journey, we grew up as meat and potatoes family.
Well, yep, I did too.
And I just, my dirty little secret is I have not conquered it, especially bacon. Like, people talk about it all the time. Like, what is it with bacon? My daughter is a vegetarian, and guess what brings her to her knees? Bacon. It's a big seductress or seducer.
Right.
But anyway, your point, that was one of my last questions about what have you done to change, and you mentioned them, and I don't want to gloss over them. You know, you change the way you eat, you change the kind of car you drive, you have solar, I'm sure they're water, you know, reducing your water use, all things that we've done. And I'm not a vegetarian yet, but my husband and I probably have reduced our meat consumption by at least 80%. You know, we used
huge.
To just put a roast in the oven.
I mean, and you're more or less there.
Yeah.
If people just reduced it by half, it would have huge impact on the environment.
And my husband can't even eat it. He does much better than I do. Really and truly, he orders a lot of vegetarian meals, and I'm not a big vegetable fan. We shouldn't be saying that on Mrs. Green's World. But we went somewhere and we had a cheeseburger, and it was, you know, antibiotic-free, cruelty-free, blah, 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 blah. The both of us got so sick because it sat in our stomachs. We're not used to that digestive process where I used to walk past, I could eat a cheeseburger any day, but there's a heaviness that goes with it. So that's unbelievable. So talk for a minute about, let's do a little bit more about ocean waste. And this isn't even a fair question. What do you think it's going to take? And I want to go into the arena a little bit of policy versus grassroots movements. And there's always debates about that. How much do we need to impact what's going on with laws? And how much do we need to impact by really the only way we can really do it is by changing people's behavior. I mean, and I can say I feel strongly both ways because I think we need both, but I would love to know what you think. I think we need some big P policy changes around plastic production and waste.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. I'm not a big policy advocate for a variety of reasons, probably because I'm an entrepreneur and business person.
Yeah, I don't want people to tell me what to do. It's
exactly.
As simple as that. I don't.
But it plays a role because people won't necessarily do it on their own, even given all the information. Because you know, if it's viewed as you know, change is difficult, and as you mentioned, the journey going from a meat eating diet for me took. Years. It took years, and it was a stepwise process.
Yes.
And for me, you know, it's not. For some people, it's more difficult than others, and I understand that. That's why I say, even if you just go lighter, that's awesome. You've done a huge contribution, and that's just one thing you can do. You know, if that doesn't work, do something else. You know, bike, change the type of vehicle you drive. You know, drive an EV or a hydrogen vehicle, etc. Those all have huge impacts. On the EV, depending on where you get your electricity from,
that's another complicated conversation. Seriously, it's all complicated. Yeah, it is. It's all complicated. People say, "What's the answer?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you have about 16 days. I'll start with the possibilities. What are the solutions? Good luck with that."
So I'll try to answer your question now. It's not an easy one. I wasn't trying to dodge it on the plastic in the oceans. There is no easy answer on getting it out. Again, the easier answer is don't put it in there in the first place. And that's you alluded to Dow and many other companies. I think they've got the message, and they are throwing money at increasing recycling facilities, even in the U.S. That was partly due to the Chinese green fence and their refusal to take our waste. So I think industries have gotten the idea that, yes, we have to stop putting in the oceans, obviously. I mean, they were on board with that a long time ago, but how to do that, I think, it's still not in place, but at least there's movements in the right direction. They're throwing money at increasing recycling in the U.S., for example, finally, after 20 years of me trying to get them to do that. Getting it out of the oceans, a lot of the organizations that I've worked with, and I know many of the fantastic NGOs on the planet trying to solve that problem, a lot of them pivoted away from trying to get it out of the oceans when they realized how difficult it was going to be and focused more on keeping it out of the oceans, which is good and understandable.
Right.
There is one very, highly advertised person that's still going at it, and I applaud him, Boyan Slat, the young Dutch kid that I think he was only maybe 16 or 18 when he first came up with his TED Talk and the crazy idea, and everybody said he was crazy. Well, he's actually got a system out in the Pacific Ocean now. They went under the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco a few months ago. There were some issues with it. They're working on it. It's awesome.
It is really awesome. And we had him scheduled for our show, and he canceled because his parents took him on a vacation. I think he was like 16, and we haven't. Then he went viral. Kelly read about it like in a magazine on the air in an airplane, and we had him. And then he sent an email and said he was going sailing. I'm not kidding. But like we heard about him first, so we know that.
Yeah.
But that's an example of a young mind. I went to we have something here called SARCEF, which is all about science and research and engineering, and I was asked to be a judge. And Mike, I had fifth graders, and I kept saying to the team leader, "Are you sure these are fifth graders? Has this been vetted?" And it was in their handwriting. I didn't feel it was a mom and dad project, but the things that fifth graders were thinking about. And I just said something to a friend. I said, who was a judge with me. I said, "I know what I was thinking about in fifth grade. My first boyfriend." I'm serious. thinking about it, not doing anything because I was only in fifth grade, but like the things that these kids were talking about and experimenting about, like one of them jumps out, the most effective solution they found for insulation for a house was sod, putting insulation on the outside. And I'm like, so that gives me hope too.
It does. And the sunrise movement that you see.
Oh my gosh. We have a chapter. Goosebumps.
I get goosebumps when I hear them talk. You know, I don't necessarily agree with every single angle they're taking, but I think it's fantastic.
Me too.
I give them support where I can.
Girls, you go. Yep.
They're awesome. They are and it's a shame. You know, I saw one segment well, NBC just did a documentary on them, and they said, so we're trying to find the adults in the room. And that's, it's just, it almost brought tears to my eyes. Yes. Why does a 16 or 14-year-old have to look for adults in the room to preserve their future? That's what breaks my heart, and that's why I do what I do.
And yeah,
they shouldn't have to be worrying about that, right? They shouldn't have to be worried
they
about
they should be worried about their next boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever.
Exactly.
I'm serious. Like, I had such a childhood that was so free of all this worry and angst.
Yep.
Really and truly blessed to know that. But to your point, the kids are our future. I went to Bioneers. I went to the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco. And when I see a 17-year-old hold an audience for 30 minutes, sometimes about their outrage about all of us not taking care of them, and sometimes about their solutions, I do take a little bit of a deep breath and say, you know, maybe there is hope, because we have a lot to do before that happens. What about, so for policy versus grassroots, it's both, you agree with it that it's both?
It's absolutely both. And I don't have easy answers on policy. I actually spent time with a lobbyist in Washington trying to get some policy around recycling. This was more than a decade ago. And it was just frustrating. It was frustrating, disheartening. The system to me felt broken. It obviously feels broken to a lot of people. Policy's long and hard, but there's a role for it, and we have to keep working on it. We have to keep getting policy in place that makes sense. But since I don't have the aptitude or the patience for policy, that's why I focus on trying to help entrepreneurs get technology solutions to the market as quickly as possible, because I can't wait for technology to fix the problem. A carbon price, by the way, that many very, very smart people, including Republicans, you know, former secretaries of state from Stanford that are now at Stanford, for example, have put together a proposal for a carbon tax where the revenues would be revenue neutral. The revenue would come back to the people. I think that's the way to go. That will solve a lot of problems. That will force companies, that simple thing will force companies to be low carbon. And just on that note, people say, well, and it's going to make us non-competitive. We're not going to be able to compete with the rest of the world if we do that. You know, I understand that resistance. It's the same about recycling plastics. I used to get that argument all the time. Oh, we can't recycle plastics. We'll be non-competitive if we, you know, institute that type of policy. Well, I've got a fantastic data point that I'd like you to take a look at and your listeners. ETHO is a ETF. It's a fund that it's a fund that only invests in low carbon publicly traded companies.
Okay.
And the measure from the low carbon is a real screen. It's not this green screen where, you know, just what do they say publicly? No, this company, the founder of ETHO, Ian Monroe, who I've met and know quite well.
And who would probably be a Stanford great show guest.
Yeah, he would be great, because this ETF's been up and running for more than 3 years. So it's got a 3-year history. It's beaten the S&P 500 for every one of those three years. And so it's outperforming standard stock markets. And its CO2 footprint of the companies in the ETF are tiny compared to the CO2 footprint pro rata on the S&P 500, for example. You can go to their website, ETHO, and just research it, because
and
it
Kelly
will give you hope.
Kelly will put the link on your show notes. I mean, people will listen and find it. Yeah, I'm going to look
it up. It's a demonstration that you can actually be more profitable if you adopt a low carbon supply chain. And he goes deep into their supply chains. This is a true green screen, came out of Stanford, the methodology. And he's proven now 3 years of data. And it's actually my best performing fund. I've got money in the fund now. So, you know, maybe this is a little self-serving, but I don't think so.
No.
I've got money in the fund, and it's outperformed all my other funds. It's my best performing fund.
It's great that you brought that up. It's great.
It's doing the right thing. I'm investing in companies that have figured out that, oh, by the way, if I have a low carbon supply chain, it probably means I have a an efficient supply chain, which means I'm more efficient than my competition. So
it's
awesome.
Business case for sustainability. It is absolutely the business case. I made a presentation this morning to a group that we want to work with them on implementing a green team. It's a huge facility. And I made the business case for cost savings. If we come in there and do a water audit and an energy audit and all of those things, they'll realize savings in what they're paying us to consult with them for the life of the property. But the I interviewed last week a really great guy. I mean, and I'm saying great guy. Bob Langert from McDonald's. He wrote a book, The Battle to Do Good, Inside McDonald's Sustainability Journey. And I actually read the book. It's hard when I have to read four books for four shows because I have other things to do. But I read this book. And to your point, some of the really big dogs. You know, I went to Joel McCower's Green Biz Conference 2 weeks ago, which, by the way, you should be a presenter. And when they have a call for presenters, I'm going to be, just so you know, I'm going to be pitching you.
Well, I know Joel well. I've known him for 20 years
plus. Why am I not surprised at all?
And I think that they're doing a carbon ever.
They are.
Whatever.
So I'll be watching.
Meeting.
And
I'm looking forward to participating in that.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to drop your name all over the place.
Thank you.
They love us because we troll for guests at those things. I mean, in such a good way. But to your point, some of the really big dogs, like Coca-Cola, like Unilever, like McDonald's, they are really, and in the case of McDonald's, and I said this to Bob on the show, I said, you know, Bob, boy, was I one of those people. They're disgusting and they are ruining the rainforest and blah, 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 blah. Well, then, God forbid, I let facts get in the way. And it's a good lesson for me to just don't do that judgment thing. And I am not advocating for everyone to go out and get a Happy Meal. Quite the contrary. But I want to applaud them. They have done lots to make our world a cleaner, healthier, more sustainable place. And when McDonald's changes their supply chain, it's the shot heard around the world.
I agree.
It's not like a little mom-and-pop grocery store, which matters, but it's really big impact. And I have high praise for them and what they did. And in some cases, it did save them money. They did realize savings, and it brought the price down for other big fast food chains. And it was a wonderful book for me to read, a wonderful lesson for me to learn about judging and stereotypes. So we're almost getting to the end, and I want to ask you, is there anything that you're going to get off and say, gosh, I wish Gina had asked this? That's one question. And the other question is, if you could narrow it down to a couple of calls to action, because the people who listen to this show are in what Seth Godin calls, they're in my tribe. They're in the Mrs. Green's workspace.
Right.
They are tribal members. It's growing. They care. We're trying to get...
I'm in your tribe now, too.
You're in the tribe. So the calls to action... You know, there's obvious where reduce your carbon in footprint and all that means.
Yeah.
But what's easy way to start? Like to me, eating meat once a week instead of five times a week is a great way to start. But what are some
or even
of
just
your calls to
just
action?
Have meatless Friday? Just taking one off. Any of that is a help. So thank you for your question. You've done a fantastic job. Nothing jumps to mind, but on the call to action, I would just point to again, you mentioned Unilever. So I give talks on innovation and my journey from plastics recycler to carbon recycler to investor in that space and on crossing the valleys of death. I give talks on those themes around the world. And I often end with what can you do? Because people ask me that.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
What can I do? Because I'm waiting.
I want to be part
of the solution. I don't want to be part of the problem. So I've started to end those presentations the last few years with part of what we scratched the surface of. So let me just kind of put that in a nutshell. So I used Unilever as an example of, well, let me back up just a second. We often look to first government to solve it for us. So we talked about policy and how long and hard that is. Has to be part of the solution, but I'm not going to talk about that right now because of how hard it is. I can't personally move the policy needle. I already tried to do that before and I'm frustrated. Number two, we look to companies, right? Oh, it's a big company's fault. You know, they're making the wrong products or they're doing things wrong. then we maybe look to communities and then or small companies, and then we look to ourselves last. Because what can I do? What can one person do? I can't do anything. So let me kind of go through those each really quickly, other than policy. So I used Unilever, since they are a leader in this space, as
no
you pointed
kidding.
Out.
No kidding. When I heard they wanted to be a B Corporation, I almost fell off my chair. I'm like, yeah, I want to see how that happens. But just that they want to is a big deal.
So, well, not only do they want to, I mean, the first CEO, I think, outside the family came in and he said, look, we're going to double the size of Unilever and we're going to half our carbon footprint. And he's been at work trying to do that.
Amazing.
In five years, yeah, they reduced their carbon footprint by a million tons.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is a big number.
Big number.
So I took that number. I divided it by the number of years over which they did that and the number of employees they have. And it turned out to be one ton per year per employee. Pretty close. I think it was 1.0 something. So one ton per year per employee. That's pretty substantial, but it's one ton per year per employee. I then did what our family did, those four changes, putting solar on the house. Okay, I realized that was expensive.
Right.
It's already, but now it's paid for.
Right.
I've had on there 7 years, so now I'm
right.
getting free energy.
Forever.
I ride my bike almost everywhere, and so does my family when they can. So I calculated what that impact was and how few miles we drive. We air dry our clothes. Okay, easy to do in California, but neighbors look at us like we're a little strange because we put their clothes out on the deck.
But it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
And we've gone mostly vegan. And we're not even 100% vegan. We just kind of mostly gone that direction.
Right,
so I did the calculations, did the math on all those things. It turned out to be 5 tons per year for each of us in our family. So 5X what a billion, multi-billion dollar company was able to do with much more resources than us, with changes that I would say made our life better, frankly.
Yeah.
So that is
healthier.
My message.
Certainly healthier.
And then I have to put my last one. I'll use my example of MBA Polymers, my former company. So we did a study. We had a Swiss research organization come in and do a life cycle assessment on our company on making plastics from waste and comparing that to making plastics from oil. And then also comparing our plant to taking waste plastics and getting energy from them instead of recycling them.
Right.
So those two metrics, long story short, making plastics from recycled plastics saved 900 tons per employee per year of CO2. 900 tons per employee per CO2. Our tiny little company in Austria. And this was confirmed. It was refereed by a Swedish expert in LCAs. So my point there is that's why when I saw that, I said, okay,
yes,
I can have impact by making changes in my personal life.
Right.
I can have even a bigger impact by investing in companies that are trying to do things in a better way. So that's why I continue to live my personal life in ways I think are helpful. But even more importantly, I'm working with small companies that are trying to bring us a cleaner energy future.
And I'll be watching, and I hope our paths cross, because this has been a wonderful show, a delightful show for me to do and to be present with you and to share your story with our listeners. So in closing, I want to promote two upcoming shows, our local show, Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Todd Hanley, who's the general manager for Hotel Congress. They have done everything you can possibly think of to reduce their carbon footprint, and they're the host for the Agave Festival here in Tucson, which is also about sustainability and preparing for the ever looming climate change. And our national show is going to be with David Kruidsma. He's the director of research for Global Fishing Watch. It's going to knock your green socks off. I'm not kidding. From the ground to the cloud, new solutions for environmental stewardship. I found out more stuff I didn't know. And here are my last words. Trust me when I say that this show has everything to do with fighting the biggest battle our world has ever faced, that of the impact of ever-present climate change. Plastic pollution is impacting our personal health, the health of those we love, the health of our fish, all of our wildlife, and the health of our oceans, thus the health of our entire planet. From where I sit, the world desperately needs more Mike Biddles. We need more people like him who see big problems and work hard to find big solutions. To me, Mike is one of those people who embodies what it means to dare greatly, and so he does. I hope you are as inspired by his story as I am, and by his impact as I am, And I hope you find out more about him and the important work he is doing. I hope you go to the websites that he mentioned. And I invite you all to remember that the 12 years to change clock is ticking, and all of our actions impact our present and our future. Thank you so much for being a part of my world.